Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. When actor Gene Wilder died last week as a result of Alzheimer's disease, it was another reminder that Alzheimer's ultimately kills its victims after having stolen memory, certain body functions, and, of course, dignity. With millions of Americans suffering from Alzheimer's, it clearly strikes millions of others in other ways. Also victimized are family and friends, many of whom are caregivers. On today's program, in recognition of World Alzheimer's Awareness Month, we'll focus on that part of the Alzheimer's story. Joining me in studio are Norris Roberts, an Alzheimer's advocate and the author of Mama is Still Here, which details his caring for his mother who had Alzheimer's. Stephanie Rolfs-Young is Vice President of Programs for the St. Louis chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Lonnie Schicker is a member of the Alzheimer's Association National Early Stage Advisory Board. She was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease in 2014. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you. An important subject. You know, I've done so many programs on this, and it really doesn't seem to improve year after year, unfortunately. But let's find out a little bit more about what's going on here. Stephanie, I'll start with you. Can you give us some indication of how many people in this area are afflicted and how it's being dealt with?
Sure. Well, we know that nationwide there are about 5 million Americans who have Alzheimer's disease, and that equates to about 110,000 Missourians and about 130,000 Illinoisans with the disease, and that incurs with all different stages of the illness. So the statistic that I often mention is about 1 in 3 families are affected by knowing somebody or having somebody in the family with the illness. What's being done about it has changed over the years, and we are so encouraged and so excited about the pace of research, the momentum that we see going on in every aspect, from care to public policy and advocacy and changes in laws, helping people with the disease, as well as just the research, which we'll hear about today.
Yes, we'll be hearing about that a little bit later. Our focus today on caregiving. Mm-hmm. Is it fair to suggest that most of the people who are suffering from Alzheimer's disease are being cared for by family?
That is true. And we know that for every person with the disease, on average, it takes about 3 family caregivers to help provide either daily care or the support that it requires to keep a loved one at home. Most people with Alzheimer's disease do live at home, and people prefer to be at home. But that doesn't go without some necessary adjustments. And you'll hear a little bit of Norris's story of how, you know, families can create a web of support for that individual.
So if there are 5 million people with Alzheimer's in the country and 3 or 4 family members are dealing with it in a caregiving situation, that number jumps to around 20 million who are directly affected
by
it.
That's right. That's right. And unfortunately, we are at the top of a lot of lists that we wish we weren't the top of. We're the fastest growing disease, the most deadly, and unfortunately, the number one most feared disease amongst Americans over the age of 50.
Yeah. Not surprising. Norris, let me turn to you and get some sense. We'll go into detail as the program unfolds, but give us some sense of what your responsibilities were in caring for your mother.
Much of the responsibility I had with my mother was just socializing her. Because one of the biggest factors in Alzheimer's is you have 2 barriers, and one is communication, and the other is cognitive skills, or cognitive decline. With my mother, in the early onset, it was much easier caring for her. I mean, much easier caring for her when she became more progressive later in the disease. But initially, it was very, very hard because you were dealing with things like sundowning syndrome. You were dealing with paranoia, some schizophrenic-like behavior, and you were just dealing with those lucid moments when she was very lucid. Then all of a sudden, she's not anymore. And so trying to transition between those 2 different things, that was a huge challenge for us. But one of the things I would say that we did very a good job at was continuing to socialize her. Many people choose to kind of go into a hiding place and not be seen anymore. And the one thing we continue to do was to continue to socialize her. And the one thing I really commend my dad on is that he continued to keep her looking the way she kept herself. He took her to the beauty shop every 2 weeks. He continued to, as she progressed through the disease, her weight change significantly. So she couldn't wear any of the clothes that she had purchased herself initially. So we had to go to a whole new wardrobe. And my dad, you know, again, what he did, he purchased clothes that he purchased things that she would purchase. And so we continued to go out to have family dinners. I continued to bring my parents to my house for family Sunday dinners because that was something that she did every week as a kid, or as a young adult when I was growing up. She always made this big Sunday dinner, and we all came over and had dinner. And so as she couldn't do it anymore, my wife took on that responsibility. And so she started to have the big Sunday dinners and invited people over. But unfortunately, fear gets in the way. And people don't feel comfortable with their behavior because they're not themselves all the time. And so our circle continued to get smaller and smaller and smaller because, unfortunately, some family members just chose not to participate. And so you're dealing with many losses as a caregiver. You're dealing with the loss of the sufferer and the memories you shared with them. And in addition to that, you also deal with, the decline in family and friends to come around that you were accustomed to making memories with. And so, I mean, I would read, like, one little quote I was sharing earlier with Nancy out in the green room earlier, because she was talking about how difficult it was to kind of go through all of this. Mm-hmm. And so in the book, it says here, "Now it is difficult for me to put words together. How do we move forward when I cannot remember his name or remember his face? This is not how I wanted my story or our story to end. Family, there is a part of me that will never forget. And you all play a significant role. The memories of me I deposited in you. Treasure our memories and think of them as keepsakes." Right. And so what I like to leave people with, you know, as I share my story, is that yet they can't. The first thing that goes is short-term memory. And what happens, they can't make new memories. Mm-hmm. They can't learn anymore. But our responsibility as caregivers is to continue to socialize and make memories with them.
Right.
And continue to do those things that we did before.
Well, thank you for all of that. That's a pretty complete picture of what you went through. How long did you go through this?
My mother, she was diagnosed. When she was diagnosed, she went on for nine more years. And so she was exhibiting, I would say, Alzheimer's symptoms much earlier. But the challenge we had was that those memory lapses were like, they kind of was far in between. Mm-hmm. And so you would see things, but the other challenge you had, that's your mother.
Yeah, sure, of course.
And she's a matriarch of the family. And so, you don't want to, you go through a period of denial where you see these things happening, but you just choose to ignore them because you think it's going to get better. And it doesn't get better. Sure. It gets worse.
Yeah. Lonnie, let me turn to you. How difficult is it for you to speak about this?
It's really not difficult at all for me to speak about it because I want people to know. And I want to put a face on it so that people aren't so fearful. Because I think, as Norris just said, fear overrides everything sometimes. It's, fear for the caregivers, but fear for the people who are suffering with the disease, worrying about what the future holds for you. How much longer am I going to be able to do this? How much longer can I drive? So there's a lot of fear involved.
Once you received the diagnosis, that was been a couple of years ago now.
Right, 2 years.
What sort of conversations have you had with family? I mean, the picture is pretty clear as to what lies ahead. So I'm sure you want to talk things over with those folks.
We've had extensive conversations about what I want, about what they want. I did planning. I have done my
advanced directives
and my living will, and I've gone over it with my family. I have left explicit instructions for everything, including when I become more confused, the kinds of things that I will and won't want. And so we've had very good conversations. My sister and my son are my main caregivers. And so the three of us are just a little team, and they're very aware.
May I ask what was happening when you felt the need to find out what was going on?
Yes, I had been having, over a period of time, some memory lapses, or I thought they were memory lapses, where I just couldn't remember doing something. I was teaching, and I would find assignments, and I would think that I couldn't remember giving that assignment. And I don't know, a lot of people have probably seen the movie Still Alice, which is about Alzheimer's, and I had that exact experience. I was actually giving a speech in Washington, D.C. on medical ethics, and I suddenly forgot. I had given it 20 times, so I knew the content well. And I suddenly forgot what I was talking about, where I was, who I was talking to, and just had a complete shutdown. And that was when I decided that those memory issues I was having were probably something bigger.
Right. And you went to whom? To a neurologist, your family practitioner?
I went to my family medicine doctor, and she recommended that I see a neurophysiologist. And so I went to see him, and he sent me for extensive testing. You can't believe the MRIs and the CAT scans and all of the written tests and trying to figure out what was wrong. And I was very fortunate to have a physician who came in the room and told me, you know, it's not Alzheimer's at this moment, but you do have a mild cognitive impairment, which is a Alzheimer's-related dementia. Mm-hmm. And you need to call the Alzheimer's Association and get some help. It's going to be a really long road, and you're going to need help. And probably the best thing that happened to us, because that was what we did immediately.
Yeah. And Stephanie, that's where the Alzheimer's Association comes in. Mm-hmm. And I'll have to take a break now. We'll come back and talk about what you folks can do and do to help people like Lonnie and Norris's mother. We'll take that break now. We are talking about Alzheimer's disease, and with me in studio is Lonnie Schicker. You just heard from her. She's a St. Louis woman who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's just a couple of years ago. Stephanie Rolfs-Young is with the St. Louis chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Norris Roberts is here with us. He is an Alzheimer's advocate and the author of Mama is Still Here, which is his story of caring for his mother during the period of time she had Alzheimer's disease. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on Alzheimer's disease and caregiving. Stephanie, what do you do when someone like Lonnie comes to you? What resources do you have available to you, and how can you help?
Well, you know, actually, Lonnie is exceptional in many, many ways, one of which is that she was diagnosed very early with the disease, and many of our clients may be more like my grandmother, who was a little bit more progressed with the disease when discovered. So Lonnie is able to take advantage of many more resources that we have available, including early stage education, support, and socialization programs. But most families call us, honestly, before they're diagnosed. They call to find out, how do I get a diagnosis, which is a difficult process sometimes for family members. We know that only 45% of people who actually have the disease get a diagnosis, because the diagnosis isn't simple and clear and easy. So much of what we do is we counsel people just about that. We work with them to find the right doctor, to get the diagnosis, to get connected to research studies if that's what they wish to do. And really the heart of what we're there for is to help guide that family through a plan that will sustain them for the remainder of whatever that looks like in their journey. So Lonnie mentioned that she's worked with her attorney to get advanced directives. She's got a medical background, so she knows that that's important. But most families are not ready for those conversations, so we're there to help aid, guide, and support them through those conversations.
What about the issue of caregiving? I mean, what sort of advice do you give? And I assume that you get together with family members at some point to talk about that.
We do. So one of our signature programs is something called a care consultation, where we sit down with as many family members as we can. You know, in this instance, we would sit down with a person with dementia like Lonnie, her son, her sister, and we really come up with a plan. And in that plan, we address everything from future care needs to how to deal with the day-to-day. You know, Norris mentioned in his mom's situation that maybe there was some paranoia, some hallucinations, things that made it difficult to always be on the same page. And caregivers need immediate information and support on those kinds of situations, which is why we're there 24 hours a day through our helpline. But also, they need guidance for emotional changes that come up. And you can deal with almost any behavior that comes at you, but it takes a toll as a caregiver when your mom doesn't recognize you or when a loved one says something that's out of character for them. So we offer ongoing support groups. We offer ongoing telephone support. We're just there for all of those pieces that are both anticipated as well as happening today.
Right. Norris, what kind of help and outside resources were you able to take advantage of?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't take advantage of a lot of Alzheimer's Association opportunities because when I started to really have difficulty, I was an entrenched caregiver. We was in it. And so it was much different. And so that's kind of why I wrote the book, because it was kind of my therapy, how I got through it. But we did use professionals, because one of the biggest challenges we had was, like, give my mother a bath. That was a huge challenge. But you would have thought it would be something that would be simple. You just hire someone, you just do it. But she didn't like the person. And so you probably went through, professionals to give her a bath, and it was only one person that she liked. And we kept that person until she passed on. So that was challenging. But I did read Steel Alice. That was a book that was read. I seen the movie. And it gave me a lot of insight. I had a situation with my mother where I picked my parents up to go to come to my house for dinner. And my mother would not go through the front door. And she kept saying that I can't step over that hole. And I was looking, and because I remember in Steel Alice, the mother would not go through, would not answer the front door, because she thought the black rug in the foyer was a hole. So just knowing that, just having that awareness, they enabled me, like, to look at that and say, "Oh, I get it. She see that as a hole in the stoop." And so I just picked it up and threw it in the mulch. And she looked at me and she started laughing. She said, "How do you do that?" You know, because I think the thing that happens is spatial integrity, it's compromised because of the disease. Like, if you look at my book cover, it's a picture of my mother looking in the mirror. And it's like three images of her in the mirror, because like three mirror panes. And I remember, what really brought this to light was the fact that I went to my parents' house. And I came, and my mother said, "That woman's in the bathroom again." And so I followed her into the bathroom, and she took me in. We got this big, long mirror in the bathroom, and she said, there she is. And I said, "Mama, that is you in the mirror. That's your reflection." And that's, I show her my reflection in the mirror, and she said, "Why does this mirror show your reflection and not my reflection?" Mm-hmm. But what it goes back to is that She could not, her memory wasn't working in a way where it enabled her to know how she looked in the present, because of that lack of memory. And so I say all this to say that, I mean, there's a lot of those kind of stories that happen. And what, as a caregiver, what you have to be able to do is be able to think quickly and know how to respond, because you don't want them to go into anxiety attack.
Sure. I'm going to turn that back to you, Lonnie, here. You have a medical background, Stephanie just said. What sort of medical background, if I may ask?
I'm a registered nurse.
Well, that certainly had to be helpful to you. How much did you have to draw upon what you know in that profession with what you're dealing with?
I think I had to draw on it a lot. I think one of the things that Stephanie was saying about how hard it is to navigate the whole system, the whole healthcare system, and to get an answer, it can be very daunting. And I think having a medical background was really helpful because I knew where to push and who to push. And so it was important.
I can see how that would be. Stephanie, to you, you know, a lot of people walk into a room and forget what they walked into that room for. And they will say, and some people consider this flip, but they're, gee, I hope I'm not getting Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. There are different grades, I guess, gradations of dementia. What can you say to people who worry about things like that and about the various degrees, if you will, of dementia below the Alzheimer's level?
Well, you know, we all forget things, and I think that's the most comforting thing to know is that all of us have walked into the room and not remembered what we're looking for or misplaced our keys or forgotten an appointment. What we're looking for and what was probably happening with Lonnie when she talked about some of those memory challenges is that we have to be aware if there's a pattern beginning. So not only forgetting something once, but seeing yourself having more and more missed appointments, missing the deadlines for paying bills, not remembering upcoming birthdays and events and those kinds of things. And all of those are signatures of what might be early stages of Alzheimer's. We have a warning signs, a list of 10 signs on our website that we really encourage people to look at and become familiar with if you have any aging parent in your family. We know that the most numbers of people who develop the disease are over the age of 65. But as Lonnie sits here today, we're seeing the signs develop earlier in people, and we need to be absolutely aware of those signature signs.
Right. Lonnie, can you relate to what has just been said there in terms of how you are impacted?
Absolutely. I think that was the red flag for me, is that the forgetfulness went beyond the, I can't remember that person's name, or I walk in a room and don't remember why I'm there. And once I realized that it went beyond that kind of normal forgetfulness, I recognized that I probably needed to see somebody and to seek additional help, because I would forget very simple things. I would lose things. I think that was the worst problem that I was having, is I would lose money, lose my debit card, lose my wallet, lose everything. And that was the biggest sign to me, I think. And then my students' assignments, you know, forgetting to show up for class. And those were things that were very uncommon for
me. We have a number of people who have emailed and tweeted us with to get into this conversation. Susan writes here, "We're just getting started. 2 months ago, my husband was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's, and I have spent time coming back from the Mayo Clinic to my hometown with many jobs." Obviously, Susan, is a lot of time is being spent on this. Stephanie, any suggestion for again, the family in this particular situation? Time is going to be taken away from jobs and friends and other things.
Absolutely. And the first thing I recommend with everybody is don't wait to get help, because the situations don't get better. You need to really understand what you're going to be facing and think about a plan for the future. So I encourage anybody who has questions to call our 24-hour helpline. That number is 1-800-272-3900. And through that, you can ask for one of these family meetings with a care consultation. Sit down with a social worker like myself, do it by phone, do it by teleconference, whatever it takes to get everybody in the room together, and start talking about what we need to do for diagnosis, for treatment, for future planning.
Again, looking at the caregiving situation, what advice for caregivers for taking care of themselves during this period?
It's incredibly important. We know that caregiver stress and caregiver burnout is very high with Alzheimer's, more so than other diseases, because the disease lasts so long. You know, Norris mentioned his mom had this disease for 9 years. My grandmother had it for 7. You have to learn to balance and accept help. And we at the Alzheimer's Association can be that voice to help you understand when you've gone too far, when you need to bring in help, when you need to start putting together a team of people who will provide that care.
Right. Okay, I have a couple of other emails here I'd like to get to. Brenda writes, how can I find the best geriatric psychologist to help work through rejection that she's feeling? I guess she's talking about a relative. Mm-hmm. In addition to having her move away from home, is counseling even a good idea?
Yeah, great ideas. And again, call that helpline. So one thing people don't realize we do is we have lists of resources. We can help you make a great selection for that physician who's going to be your provider for the future. And then we can recommend the counselors or the types of individuals who will be there for your mom, your loved one down the road.
Mm-hmm. We also have an email here from Bob who would appreciate a recommendation on a website that goes into depth on many of the specific criteria for each stage. I assume that your website does that. You've indicated you've got a lot of that kind of information.
We do. And a shortcut would be to go to www.alz.org/care. And in that, it's a caregiver website just specifically designed to help people understand the stages of the disease, treatment options, all of the different components that you're going to need to know.
Right. Okay. And let me have you heard of an outfit called the Memory Care Home Solutions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. We have an email here just saying that the audience would appreciate knowing what that is. I guess it's some sort of service that helps people at home.
It does. So Memory Care Home Solutions is a nonprofit organization based here in St. Louis. They serve the St. Louis and surrounding area. And their goal is to help people make the adaptations that you need at home to keep your loved one staying at home. They can offer up to a year of occupational therapy visits to come in, assess the home situation, and provide that care. We make referrals all the time to organizations just like that to help caregivers figure out who I'm going to need as part of my care team.
Right. Our time is winding down, and I know you've got a big event coming up this weekend with regard to the Alzheimer's Walk.
We do, yes.
And tell us about that.
So our signature fundraising event is this Saturday, September 10th at Scott Trade Center. It is Walk to End Alzheimer's, which last year occurred in 600 different locations. Our goal this Saturday is to raise $1 million for Alzheimer's services and the research that Dr. Schindler is going to tell you about.
Okay. All righty. Well, we'll look forward to talking to her. Let me ask each of you to put a bottom line on all of this. What, Norris, do you want the takeaway to be from people who may or may not be in your position at some point?
My takeaway is don't bury your head in the sand. Continue to live life. Continue to socialize your sufferer. Continue to live. Don't make this be the end.
How did you take care of yourself during this period?
I had a good group of people around me. A lot of encouragement. I rely a lot on my faith. A lot on prayer. I did a lot of that, and just a lot of research. I did a lot of research on the Alzheimer's Association's website. Mm-hmm. They got a very, very good website.
We'll put a link to that, by the way, on ours, so people can get to it very, very quickly. Okay, and Lonnie, a final thought from you?
Well, I think the most important thing is that if you are the person who has the disease, to rely on those people who want to help you. And if you're the people who are caring for people like me, to rely on one another and to rely on organizations like the Alzheimer's Association to get all of the information you can, I think it does make it easier.
What is your view of the future? How do you look ahead?
I'm very optimistic. I just feel like I still have a lot of life left to live, and I am adjusting as things progress. I can't do some things that I used to be able to do, but there are still things I'm very capable of doing, and I'm going to do everything that I can for as long as I can.
Well, the very best of luck to you. Our best wishes, of course, to you, Lonnie.
Thank you.
Final thoughts, Stephanie?
Don't wait to seek help. There are so many families who get into a more difficult and challenging situation because they haven't reached out. We're at the pinnacle of some amazing developments. We're starting to talk about prevention. We're starting to talk about major life changes with this disease. So we want people to reach out for help.
Okay, well, thank you all so much for being with us and bringing us up to speed on this part of the Alzheimer's story, and an important part of the story it is. Lonnie Schicker, again, very best of luck to you and our best wishes to you.
Thank you.
Rolfs-Young, thank you so much for being with us. Keep up the good work at the association
thank you.
And good luck on Saturday. Norris Roberts, thank you for being with us. The book, once again, is Mama is Still Here. A lot of good information in that book. Thank you so much all for being here. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. Where are we with regard to making progress in the fight against Alzheimer's? Joining me in studio is Dr. Suzanne Schindler. She is a neurologist at Washington University School of Medicine. She diagnoses and treats patients with Alzheimer's disease, also involved in research at the Knight Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
I hope, I said just before you went on the air, I hope you bring some good news, but we've done this program before, and just generally, how much farther ahead are we in research, diagnosis, and treatment than we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago?
I think that we've made tremendous progress. So especially in the last 10 years, we've made a lot of discoveries about the proteins involved in Alzheimer's disease, how they're made, how they're processed. And we've developed drugs that target these different processes. So we've made a tremendous amount of progress in understanding the disease and targeting it. Where we're at now is where we're actually testing these drugs on patients. And those trials take a long time and are difficult, but that's where we're at. And hopefully in the next 5 years, we'll actually have drugs that are approved that we can be prescribing to patients.
I understand you're still in trials, and that and I know what that means. But what have you seen in terms of the effectiveness of the things that you're working on?
So just to give a little context, the drugs that are currently FDA approved to treat Alzheimer's disease don't actually affect the brain disease of Alzheimer's. They don't change what's going on in the brain. They change levels of chemicals, so it kind of helps with the symptoms a little bit. But the drugs that are under development now, they actually slow down the disease process and may help, in some cases, clear some of the proteins that are causing the actual disease. So the drugs are quite different, and I think there's a real possibility that some of these drugs could actually prevent the disease process or slow it down, or maybe in some cases reverse the disease process.
Is this the likely ultimate path, that it's going to be a drug that's going to be administered to deal with it?
I think so. There's a number of different possibilities for drugs that are being trialed. Some of them are injections. Some of them are going to be oral pills that you take. Mm-hmm. I think that many of them will have to be administered quite early in the course of disease to be effective.
Yeah, we just talked. I'm sure you heard part of the conversation.
Yes.
with Lonnie here, diagnosed 2 years ago, early onset. Is she a candidate, for instance, for participating in trials such as the things that you're doing?
So I haven't evaluated her case specifically.
Yeah. But people like her?
Absolutely. So on the National Institute of Aging website, there's actually 143 clinical trials that are registered. And many of these are not drug trials, but they're all investigations designed to improve our diagnosis and treatment of Alzheimer's disease. And there are quite a few drug trials that are currently underway that people can enroll in.
You know, it seems that we have learned so much in recent years about the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we haven't learned all that much about cause of Alzheimer's. Or have we? Am I behind the loop on this?
I actually think we've learned a lot about the cause. I think that there's still uncertainty. There's certainly controversies. And things remain to be clarified 100%. But compared to where we were, say, 10 or 20 years ago, where We have incredibly improved our information base, and I think we have a much better idea of what's going on. Now, there's still that we have still a lot that we have to learn, but I think we know a lot, and I think we know enough that we can develop better drugs than what we have right now.
Where is WashU in the scheme of things? I mean, obviously research is going on in a lot of different places and a lot of different parts of the world. Where does WashU fit into all of this?
Well, I'm biased since I work at WashU.
We accept that.
I've been there since 2000. But WashU is really one of the premier Alzheimer's disease research centers in the world, really one of the absolute top centers. And has really led the way in many different aspects of understanding Alzheimer's disease, one of which is understanding that Alzheimer's disease actually starts in the brain about 10 to 20 years before people develop symptoms. So it's really a leader. And one place where we're a leader now is developing new drugs for Alzheimer's disease and testing these drugs. One study, the Dominantly Inherited Alzheimer's Network Trials Unit, that's an international study that's being coordinated at WashU. And I think that it's incredibly very high profile and has a great chance of leading to drugs for Alzheimer's disease, not just for people who have rare genetic mutations, but for all patients with Alzheimer's disease. And this was really started at WashU.
What about coordinating this research? As I've indicated, I know it's going on in a lot of different places, but you don't want to have everybody going doing the same thing when actually you could be coordinating perhaps and taking some shortcuts.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And there are quite a few studies going on. Some of this coordination, it depends on the trial. So, for example, many drug trials have many different sites, but there's a central site that coordinates all the different sites. There's also all these trials require a lot of funding, and the funders in some ways coordinate because they don't fund multiple studies that are looking at the same thing.
Mm-hmm. What do we know about the cause?
So, we know that there's a protein called amyloid that's very important. And if you have mutations in the gene for amyloid, it can cause Alzheimer's disease. And we know that mutations in other genes that are related to Alzheimer's disease, that those genes affect amyloid and cause Alzheimer's disease. So we know amyloid's critically important. This amyloid protein deposits in the brain in these structures called plaques, and we believe that that triggers a whole cascade of events that culminates in death of nerve cells and leads to dementia. So we don't know every single step along the pathway, but we know quite a few, and we think this amyloid is the initial step that sets everything off.
Is this something that could be called a breakthrough in what we're learning today about ways to deal with it? I'm looking at my notes here that about an antibody that was written about very recently, and it's considered it was sometimes media does this breakthrough in Alzheimer's. It's a word that shouldn't be used unless it actually is a breakthrough. But it can almost completely clear the visible signs of Alzheimer's disease from the brain.
So there have been reports this week about a drug called aducanumab. And some of the data had actually come out about a year ago, but it was just recently published. And so the media has been paying more attention to this. And I think it's actually very exciting. I think breakthrough may be appropriate, actually, because what we're seeing with this drug is that these amyloid plaques that I said are what trigger the disease are actually getting cleared away by this drug. So we have ways to take a picture of the brain and see these plaques. And we see that when people get this drug, the plaques actually go away. What is less clear is if people then do not progress or whether they actually get better. And there's some early evidence that they may not get not get worse, at least. So the drug may not just be helping with the disease process. It may actually be preventing worsening of dementia. But a lot of these studies are going to take more time, and there's going to be more studies to show that this drug actually does what it needs to do, which is slow down Alzheimer's disease or maybe one day prevent Alzheimer's disease.
And all the studies and the research that has gone on, have any conclusions been drawn as to who is most at risk? Is there a profile of someone perhaps who is more at risk?
So we know that there's a variety of genetic risk factors. There's a gene called apolipoprotein E, which if you have a specific form of it, you're at higher risk. In general, if you have a number of family members, particularly young family members when they develop Alzheimer's disease, that increases your risk. We also know that some lifestyle factors can affect your risk for dementia. So, for example, if you have what we call vascular risk factors, which are smoking and diabetes, high blood pressure, that these things increase your risk for dementia. And we don't know exactly why that is yet, but we know that those things do seem to play a role.
What should people do who have a family history of Alzheimer's? Obviously, there would be concern there. I would certainly have to assume that. But is there something they can do or should do?
Well, so one thing just to keep in mind is that most of us actually have some family history of Alzheimer's disease, because it turns out that if you live to be 80 or 90 years old, about half of us are going to get it. So most of us.
Half of us?
About half.
Really?
Half of people that are 85 to 90 have Alzheimer's disease. It's staggering.
Well, it almost bowled me over here.
It's
incredible.
It is. But first of all, most of us have this in our family history somewhere. Now, what can we do about it? Well, it's a little bit limited, but we know that if you exercise, if you eat right, if you keep your weight at a healthy level, if you stay away from smoking, if you just do those good living
things. A
little
healthy lifestyle, sure.
Exactly. That can help reduce your risk.
What about brain exercises? I have a relative who shall remain unnamed who has a family history of people living to be 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He's scared to death of Alzheimer's. He does crossword puzzles every day, and he laughs about it, but he's serious, saying, if I do this all the time and exercise my brain, I'm less likely to get it. Is he right?
I think he is right to an extent. So we found that engagement, so that means being physically active, socially active, cognitively active, just stimulating your brain, keeping it active, is good for you and probably does decrease your risk of dementia. But that said, there's plenty of very smart, very engaged people that mm-hmm. do go on to get Alzheimer's disease. So it's not an absolute, but it may help to some degree.
Can't hurt.
No.
It can't hurt. We have a caller here who wants to get into an area that I'd like to discuss with you. So let's bring in John, calling from Hazelwood. Go ahead, John. You're on the air with Dr. Susan Schindler.
Hello. Yes, I'd like to know what the current level of expenditure is in the United States on Alzheimer's research, and how it's, is it increasing or staying the same every year? How's that working out?
So there is a significant expenditure on Alzheimer's research. I don't know the exact numbers, but I do know that there has been some efforts to increase that funding. That said, I know that if you compare research funding for Alzheimer's disease to other major diseases, like, for example, cancer or HIV, that Alzheimer's research is still quite underfunded. And that's particularly relevant because Alzheimer's disease is an incredibly expensive disease. We spend a lot of money on nursing home care and lost wages of family members caring for people for Alzheimer's. So there is funding. I do not think it's sufficient, and I think there's more that needs to be done with regards to increasing funding for Alzheimer's disease.
So HIV, it's all a lifestyle issue, but here it's something that we really don't know the fundamental causes, and it seemed like we should be spending much more on it.
So I do agree that we need to spend more on Alzheimer's disease research.
Where do you get your funding?
So I get funding from the National Institutes on Aging, so it's the federal government, and the vast majority of Alzheimer's research is funded by the federal government. Mm-hmm. There's also important funding from the Alzheimer's Association, and that's a large source of funding for all basically all the research that goes on in Alzheimer's disease and a lot of research that goes on at Washington University. Actually, the Alzheimer's Association, funded partly by Edward Jones, has contributed $9 million to this research project called the DIAN-TU, or Dominantly Inherited Alzheimer's Network, which is designed to rapidly discover drugs for Alzheimer's disease.
You know, it's 50% of the aging population doesn't get cancer, 50% doesn't get heart disease, but more than that will likely get Alzheimer's. It's really striking that funding is scarce for this.
I think one reason for that is for a long time people have had the idea that being demented, getting quote, senile, is just part of getting old, that it's normal. And I think that now that we understand more about the biology, we know that this isn't normal. This is a disease state. We know that there are plenty of people who live to be 100, like
your relative.
We know that it's not inevitable, and it's possible that we may be able to develop drugs to prevent this from happening. So I think this is really important.
Where would you guess that we are right now in all of this in terms of reaching the ultimate objective?
Well, it depends on what that ultimate objective is. I think that in the next 5 to 10 years, I'm very optimistic that we'll have FDA-approved drugs that help slow down the Alzheimer's disease process in the brain. I don't know how well those drugs will work, if they help a little bit or if they'll help a lot. I think it may be some time, maybe 20 or 30 years before we really make a huge difference in terms of decreasing the rates of dementia in the elderly. I think that's going to require a lot of work and coordination for many different reasons. It's a whole public health issue.
Less than a minute left, but in the research that you're doing, are you looking for volunteers or people to work with to help you in this research?
Absolutely. We're always looking for volunteers, specifically people who are older than age 65 and people who have memory problems, and they can contact Washington University Alzheimer's Disease Research Center if they're interested.
We'll put that information on our website. But when you talk about, and again, only 30 seconds, when you talk about memory issues, we mentioned forgetting where you put the car keys is a memory issue, but what kind of issues specifically?
We're looking for a decline over time, so a significant difference that has you concerned, where you didn't have this problem a couple of years ago, but now there's a consistent problem where you're forgetting appointments, repeating yourself, misplacing items.
When it gets in the way,
exactly,
day to day.
Exactly.
Dr. Suzanne Schindler, thank you so much for being with us. This is fascinating stuff. I hope your timetable is met, if not sooner rather than later. But thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air, production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.